Before Scott Simon left town to accept his honorary degree at Lake Forest College, he dropped off this installment of NPR's in-character series, Good Old Charlie Brown.
Charlie Brown is the kid who always misses the football because Lucy snatches it away just before he can kick it. The kid who's left out on the pitcher's mound in the rain. The kid whose kite gets snarled in a tree. The kid who leaps into a pile of leaves and hits a rock. He has a hopeless crush.
Dear little red-haired girl, how I've longed to meet you. Oh!
Which, like some embarrassing bruise, he mistakenly reveals to his friends. Judith Viorst, who writes books for adults and children and studies psychoanalysis, says of Charlie Brown,
I like him enormously, and I think the whole world likes him.
Good grief, Charlie Brown, you're ridiculous!
Boy, were you dumb in school today.
It's your own fault, because you're so wishy-washy.
You're hopeless, Charlie Brown, completely hopeless.
Just nobody in his comic strip likes him.
Charlie Brown, whom his own dog calls that round-headed kid, came into the world in October of 1950, drawn by Charles Schulz, who named him after one of his art instructors in Minneapolis. By the time Charles Schulz died in 2000, Charlie Brown and his friends in the comic strip Peanuts appeared in almost 3,000 newspapers in 75 different countries. They starred in top-rated television specials, books, and a musical. Their images may have appeared on more things, T-shirts, greeting cards, party wear, calendars, and balloons in the last half of the 20th century than Mao Zedong's. Lynn Johnston, who draws the strip for better or for worse, says of Charlie's image,
it's like an emblem or as memorable as the Coke sign or the Nike swipe or anything else. You see that Charlie Brown, and that just says it all. It really does. That expression, that simple line, and just that wonderful look.
The Apollo 10 astronauts even named their command module Charlie Brown, and the lunar rover Snoopy. It may be telling that Charlie got to orbit the moon, but Snoopy landed there, while Charlie just circled in darkness.
Oh, good grief.
Anthony Rapp, who played Charlie in the 1999 revival of the musical You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, observes,
you think of him as sort of a sad sack, but he's also incredibly resilient, and that's a thing that I discovered in playing him.
I like you, Charlie Brown. Signed, Little Red-Haired Girl. Boy! Just wait till September, boy, just wait!
I moved around a lot as a child, saying goodbye to old friends, trying to fit in with new ones. But Charlie Brown and his friends could always be found along the wall, on the ball field, or in front of Snoopy's doghouse. He seemed to be the soul of can-do Kennedy-era optimism, but nagged by anxieties that would bring him to Lucy's backyard therapy stand. Did his dog really like him, or just the food he brought? Would the stars stay up in the sky? And what made him just a little different?
Maybe you have pantophobia. Do you think you have pantophobia?
What's pantophobia?
The fear of everything.
That's it!
Lynn Johnston became a friend of Charles Schulz's, but she grew up knowing Charlie Brown in Northern Ontario.
When you're young, you have incredibly strong emotions and really profound thoughts, but you just don't have the vocabulary or the experience to know how to voice those opinions. And so when somebody in such a wonderful medium as a comic strip could give us a voice, that was impressive.
Over the years, Charles Schulz occasionally estimated that Charlie Brown, Lucy, Linus, and Schroeder all seemed to be suspended at about 8 years of age. Judith Viorst reminds us that's an unkind age for children.
They seem to have these cruel measures of success, which poor Charlie is not very good at. I think they would admire him if his team ever won a ball game, if he ever succeeded in flying a kite. I think basically he is perceived by these otherwise decent kids, but pretty harsh in their judgment of him, as he's perceived as a loser, as a failure in the world of kiddom.
So we asked three residents of Kiddom, Ian Green, Andrew Simmons, and Maribel Allen, all from Los Angeles and all 11 years of age, to talk about the Charlie Brown that they've grown up with. Mr. Green goes first.
He's cool in his own way. He's not one of those kids that thinks, oh, you know what, I'm going to wear these awesome sunglasses, my awesome gangster leather jacket, you know? I'm so cool. He's his own person. He's his own character in his own mind, and he's very creative.
He's in his own box. If you could picture that.
You know, I think political consultants would call that authenticity.
Charlie Brown does things different.
Yet it's an old childhood story. The nicer Charlie Brown is, the more it seems to irritate people, who mock him as wishy-washy. When Anthony Rapp played Charlie Brown on Broadway, he got to sing along with what amounts to Charlie's credo.
Happiness is two kinds of ice cream.
Knowing a secret.
Climbing a tree.
Happiness is five different crayons.
Catching a firefly, setting him free.
A lot of critics found the song a little wishy-washy. 10 years later, Mr. Rapp still ruminates about the boy he played.
I don't know that he'll ever really be able to fully find happiness because, well, it would be interesting to see as he grows up whether he'd be able to continue to weather those storms over and over and over again, or if they would in fact make all of the sort of hope leak out of him.
This time I'm gonna kick that football clear to the moon! Ah!
But what use is hope if there's never any reward? For 50 years, Lucy held out the football for Charlie Brown. For 50 years, he ran at it, only to have her snatch it away and make him fall on his back. In a world that says, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me, what do you say after being fooled for 50 years? Is Charlie Brown a good man who trusts others, or a fool who deceives himself? Lynn Johnston says she didn't find Charlie's unflagging faith in Lucy to be endearing.
I always kind of thought that he should probably tell her off.
But Judith Fiorst and Anthony Rapp think that would be a false note for Charlie Brown.
You're asking him to be a far more cynical person than he will ever be in his life. I mean, he is your absolute model of hope springs eternal. Lucy always assures him that it's going to be different this year, and he figures, why not believe her?
And now you could argue that that's just foolishness, but I argue that it's actually optimism. And a certain kind of optimism, like continuing to give somebody the benefit of the doubt, believing in the better nature of people.
We asked our panel of childhood experts on Charlie Brown. Is there something that you'd like to tell him? I mean, if you could reach into that cartoon panel.
I would say, you ought to know that you're in a comic book for the past 50 years. And I would ought to say, don't listen to other people. Be yourself.
I would say, don't always be so angry at yourself. You know, if you do one thing wrong, doesn't mean that you have to get all mad and say, why didn't I do this? Why didn't I do that?
Charlie Brown can't leap tall buildings in a single bound. He can't even get his kite out of a tree. He isn't a cartoon character who bristles with superpowers. But he may be something more extraordinary among children, not to mention adults, as we all grow up and struggle to get noticed, be pretty, funny, or popular, and win candy, stars, ribbons, grades, friends, lovers, money, or toys. Ian Green says,
Charlie Brown is like, you know, oh, Captain America, he saved the people from the burning building. Charlie Brown became this famous and this special from just being himself. He doesn't have to be a superhero. That's what makes him a famous comic book character.
Despite all temptation and frustration, his bruised heart and backside, Charlie Brown is nice. And do we tell ourselves often enough? Do we tell our children how important that really is?
For happiness is anyone and anything. That's loved by you.
You're a good man, Charlie Brown.
Scott Simon, NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition, directed by Elaine Heintzman, and produced by Darcy Bacon, Justine Kennan, Bridget McCarthy, Janaea Williams, MJ Davis, Elliot Hannon, Zoe Chase, and Sarah Beyer Kelly. Our technical director is Burke Hun, so ably assisted by Lamar Nickens, Marty Curcius, and Handy Andy Rosenberg. Librarians are Key Molesky, Mary Glenn Denning, and Robert Goldstein. The senior editor is Tony Marcano. And the senior producer of Weekend Edition Saturday is Peter Breslow. Dr. Simon returns next week. I'm John Itzde. If you're driving the Atlantic seaboard later this month, you may catch a curious sight, a bright green double-decker bus headed toward Baltimore. It will be traveling very, very slowly. Don't get annoyed and start honking, because on board is a tiny troupe of circus performers returning to Europe after a world tour that has lasted more than a decade. NPR's John Burnett met up with the Sprocket Circus in Texas.
Two circus performers are entertaining a crowd on the tree-shaded deck outside of Central Market in Austin on a recent Sunday afternoon. The show is good, but not terribly unusual. There's juggling, a unicycle, acrobatics, and lots of slapstick humor. What's remarkable about the Sprocket Circus is their itinerary. On the road nonstop since 1997, they've performed for audiences in 33 countries, from street kids in Calcutta to the Sultan of Brunei, and in hundreds of villages from Turkey to Thailand to Guatemala. They ship their bus between continents on container ships, which, at $5,000 per trip, keeps them a subsistence circus.
I'm Isabelle Farrow. I'm French, and I've been doing circus show for 16 years.
And my name is Scott Harrison. I'm from Bath in England, and I started doing circus when I met Izzy 16 years ago.
They travel with their now 11-year-old son, Teo, who was away playing with new friends during this interview. The fourth member of the troupe is a lime green 1962 Bristol double-decker bus.
There we go, 45 years. Beautiful.
How is it that your bus only goes 33 miles an hour top speed?
It was designed as a city bus. It was designed to just pick people up and drop people off around a city. So there was no need for it to go any faster than 33 miles an hour. And at the time, in 1962, when this bus was made, 33 miles an hour was quite a respectable speed.
As the old double-decker has chugged along highways in Iran, Nepal, Singapore, Colombia, and California, it has taught the circus family things about the people who inhabit these places. It has taught them about the notion of civilization.
You know, you don't see a bus like this every day, and you still, people will get you the finger because you're too slow or shout at you, swear at you, you know.
Yeah. When you're driving your bus in a third world country, you
don't
get the finger,
wave,
and they don't shout at you?
No, they wave, and they're just so happy, and, you know, it's just so different. And then you feel, hey, this is what you call a civilized country, because civil mean polite.
In this respect, of all the places they've traveled all over the world, their least favorite was right here in the USA, the Golden State.
We had a lot of finger in California. We had a lot of people shouting.
Yeah, it wasn't a good place. We didn't enjoy California, and I don't think they enjoyed us.
They're speaking from inside the bus, crammed with trapeze rigging, costumes, golf clubs, Teo's school books and Lego, and a wood-burning stove. The Sprockets have lived in this bus on the road for so long, they've noticed how the digital revolution has changed the world, selectively. Cell phones and text messaging is everywhere, but some cultures seem to have surrendered to it more than others. Izzy and Scott have watched how some places, particularly in Latin America, still prize human interaction over wireless communication.
And then when you get back to the West with all our high-tech stuff, you see how people have lost all their communication skills. You know, the really important skills, not emailing people, but just being able to sit and meet a piazza and exchange conversation, just sit there and have a drink together. It's not happening enough.
This adventure is about to be over. They're still looking for a few more gigs on the East Coast in the next few weeks. But when their U.S. visas expire next month and their bus is in the hold of a ship steaming towards Southampton, England, they hope to find a real home in Europe. Izzy says she's ready.
The circus is my passion, and that I will not stop. But now I wouldn't mind having a base, somewhere where every day I can stop. I wouldn't mind having a garden, something that I can plant my flowers, you know. I wouldn't mind having a cat or a dog, you know. And that's the kind of thing that I miss.
How long they stay put is anybody's guess. Scott Harrison's next project is to acquire a boat that will accommodate the bus, then take their tiny circus to small islands inaccessible by commercial freighter, the Sprocket's second world tour. John Burnett, NPR News, Austin.
Oprah Winfrey has a talk show, a couple of magazines, a recently announced TV network, and now a boutique. At the newly opened Oprah store in Chicago, fans can purchase all things O, from tea sets to workout wear. They can even visit a section of the store called Oprah's Closet to shop for clothes once worn by the media mogul. Chicago Public Radio's Adrian Hill went to check it out.
Can I try this on?
Yes, you may.
Do you want to try it on right now?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Oh, okay.
Thanks.
I'm in the dressing room at the Oprah store, about to try on one of Oprah's old dresses. It is a linen brown dress. All right, no luck for me.
Thank you, it didn't work.
Thanks.
The dress that didn't work was $240. There are about a dozen other items from Oprah's Closet for sale today, ranging from $75 for a pair of pants to hundreds of dollars for a silk gown. All have a tag of authenticity. Proceeds go to Oprah's charity. Some have been worn, others not. Store manager Darcy Rogers says some shoppers like to check out designer duds at reduced prices. Others like the idea of getting close to Oprah.
Especially if you admire someone as much as most people do. Miss Winfrey, you want a piece of that as well.
Today, most people are shopping in other parts of the store. A lot of unworn bathrobes, tea sets, and sweaters are getting boxed up for Mother's Day. But a few do check out Oprah's Closet.
I'm just amazed at how big Oprah's feet are, actually, to tell you the truth. That's the most shocking thing to me.
Kim Stanton is also disappointed by Oprah's size 10 feet. She really likes a pair of white peep-toe heels. She's here with her friend Abby Hanrahan, who finds the whole thing a little weird.
It's like a thrift store, but I know their Oprah wore them. Although she's cool, it kind of grosses me out. I don't know, maybe my mom would think it would be cool to like hang it up in her closet and be like, oh, Oprah wore this, but yeah.
Other Oprah fans have a whole different view of the closet. Sandy Magnus checks out the scuff soles of a pair of Oprah's shoes.
Look, she wore them.
She's shopping with her friend Dana McWhorter. The clothes seem to offer them both a real connection to Oprah. For them, Oprah's big shoes are both metaphorical and literal.
I look at the clothes and I think they're beautiful, but on the other hand, like, they're big shoes to fill, really.
Right.
So I would feel kind of...
Could I ever wear Oprah's clothes and pull off an Oprah, you know?
They admire a silk Vera Wang dress, a dress that caught a few eyes today. But while I'm there, none of Oprah's clothes are sold. Not even the $75 slacks, complete with their afterglow of fame. For NPR News, I'm Adrian Hill in Chicago.
Breaking news now about late-night TV. NBC was planning to make the announcement next week, but the news leaked. Jimmy Fallon from Saturday Night Live will replace Conan O'Brien when O'Brien takes over The Tonight Show 1 year from now and Jay Leno steps back. NPR's Kim Masters reports on the musical chairs at the late night desk that could involve more than one network.
Last time there was a changing of the guard at The Tonight Show, back in the early 90s, there was such a dramatic battle to succeed Johnny Carson that it inspired a book, The Late Shift, and that became an HBO movie. It depicted the intense competition for the crown between David Letterman and Jay Leno.
You know, these network guys, you know, they can't make up their mind. They think they can just flip a coin. Dave or Jay, Jay or Dave, doesn't matter.
You think that's what the meeting's about, choosing between you and Dave?
I don't care what the meeting's about. I've given them everything they've asked for. I've given them the demos. I've given them the numbers. If I'm the one going down, I'm going down swinging.
Bill Carter was the author of The Late Shift, and he covers television for The New York Times. He may yet write a sequel.
If things go wrong, there'll be a book, and there is the potential for things to go wrong.
NBC has tried to ensure an orderly succession. Back in 2004, it laid out its plans. Conan O'Brien would replace Jay Leno in 5 years. But as the time draws near, the changing of the guard raises big questions in a time slot that's still lucrative for the networks. For NBC, the issue is whether Conan O'Brien can make a transition from an approach that works well at 12:30 to appeal to The Tonight Show's broader audience an hour earlier.
The challenge for Conan is going to be that, unlike most of these guys who've done the show, and certainly Letterman and Leno, Conan never went around to clubs and performed as a stand-up.
Bill Carter says O'Brien has already started doing a longer opening monologue, which is a staple of The Tonight Show. But Sherri-Ann Brill, who analyzes programming for advertisers, thinks O'Brien's challenge may go beyond perfecting an opening monologue.
His programming is much edgier, and I believe that if Leno was in a competitive time period, his core fan base would go to Leno and not go to Conan.
Which raises the question, what will Jay Leno do? For 6 months, nothing, at least not on television. He'll remain under contract to NBC while Conan O'Brien tests his wings. Bill Carter says Leno is keeping uncharacteristically quiet about his plans after that.
I think it's kind of predictable what he'll do because of the nature of his, you know, philosophy, which is I'm a guy who tells jokes at 11:30 at night.
And Leno will have a couple of networks in hot pursuit. Sherri-Ann Brill thinks Fox could land him, but the Fox News shows end at 11, meaning that Leno would get going half an hour earlier than his competition. Carter thinks that could be a problem.
If it is in his soul to go and kick NBC's butt for getting rid of him, and a lot of people think it is, then he's got to go head-to-head for it to be an easy comparison. I think that's the problem that Fox will have. No matter how much money they put on the table, believe me, it's not going to come down to that.
But Carter says ABC could provide the 11:30 time slot that Leno might desire, and ABC wouldn't hesitate to kill off Nightline. That scenario might annoy Jimmy Kimmel, whose show now starts at 12:05. If Leno goes to ABC, Kimmel would be pushed back to 12:35. And late-night hosts like to progress to earlier time slots, not the other way. So if Kimmel got miffed, he could wind up at Fox, and with all the potential for turmoil, Bill Carter could wind up with another book deal. Kim Masters, NPR News.